Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Brendan Mackey. He's a professor at Griffith University, Queensland, Australia, and is director of the university's Climate Change Response Program, which promotes a multidisciplinary approach to climate change problems. His PhD was in tropical forest ecology, and he's published widely in the related fields of biodiversity, ecosystems, conservation, and climate change. His current research is focused on the role of ecosystems in climate change mitigation adaptation. He serves on the Global Governing Council of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure, Derek. Good to be here.
So the first question I would like to ask is if you can talk a little bit about Australia and its pre-conquest biodiversity and its current biodiversity. If you can just talk for a few minutes about how it used to be and how it is now.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, the thing to realize about Australia is that it's a nation state that is responsible for an entire continent. Okay. So the area of the continent of Australia is about the same size as the area of Conterminous, USA. Right? So it's about the same geographic area as the USA minus Alaska and Hawaii and the other areas that fall under USA government jurisdiction. So it's a very large country, and it's as diverse environmentally and geographically as what the USA is. So the north part of Australia is in the tropics. Northern Australia, as we call it, is in the tropics. And southern Australia, some of your listeners may have heard of Tasmania. You know, it has snow and ice and ancient Gondwanic forests. And in the middle, we have a large arid and semi-arid zone. We have incredible forests. So we have all the, you know, similar range of biodiversity and ecosystem types to what you find right across North America, from the top of your country to the bottom and east to west. And like the USA, the Australian continent has been inhabited by people for a very long time, long before the Europeans turned up. You know, the English came here in the 1770s, but the Dutch kind of dropped in a few times 100 years before that. But there have been people calling Australia home for a very long time. In fact, the earliest known records of human occupation in Australia go back 50,000 years. So there's been Aboriginal Australian culture, you know, is said to be the oldest continuous human culture on the planet, that we know about. And of course, with all Indigenous people, it was not a single tribe of people. There were maybe around 700 distinctive tribes with their distinctive languages, and of course their own relationships to land and their biodiversity. You know, I think in the North America, there's been a lot of evidence that when the First Nations appeared on the continent, they interacted with some of the megafauna. You know, there's evidence that there was some of the megafauna went extinct due to that first contact. The evidence is a lot less clear in Australia for that. We did have megafauna extinctions. They weren't as severe and over such a short time and so recently as what they were in North America. But certainly, you know, when Captain Cook claimed the continent for the British Empire in 1770, and then proceeded to colonise it in 1778, every plant and animal species present then had been on this continent for a very, very long time, 4 million of years. So what we know is that just about every plant and animal species that Captain Cook found had coexisted with the Aboriginal Australians for millions of years. There was a few exceptions, but, you know, that's the general story. Which is not to say that Aboriginal Australians had no impact on the ecology of land. Of course they did. If you have people living, for a start, they're hunting, so they become a ecologically, if you like, they become the top predator. There was also a lot of evidence that Aboriginal people used fire management in various ways. So, but it's also a fact that Aboriginal people over a very long period of time reached a, if you like, a dynamic equilibrium with the natural ecology of the Australian continent. And of course, being an island continent, largely an island continent, Australia has it's mega diverse and has a very high proportion of species that are endemic to the continent that are found nowhere else. And which the Australian continent, being a southern continent, did not experience the same degree of a glaciation that, say, North America and Northern Europe did. So much more of its biodiversity persisted through those oscillating ice ages that occurred every 100,000 years or so through the Pleistocene over the last 1 to 2 million years. So Australia has a lot of plants and animals that date back to the ancient continent of Gondwana land, when Australia and India and South America were all connected to Antarctica. So you can still go to places today in Australia where you can still see those species that first evolved on the ancient Gondwanic continent. Now,
what might be an example of a couple of those species?
I can give you the Latin name. There's a genus called Podocarpus. It can grow as a tree or a plant, but there's only a handful of Podocarpus is the genus name, and there's only a handful of Podocarpus species. There's a couple found in Australia, and there's a couple found in Chile.
Hmm.
Right? So, and also there are some other plant species, which are found on the southwest coast of Australia, which are also found in South Africa. So it's possible to find certainly plant species which evolved on the ancient kind of supercontinent of Gondwana land, which kind of drifted off either to South America or Australia or South Africa. It's a fascinating kind of evolutionary story. And you can see chapters of it right through the Australian continent. So that's how it was, of course, when the Europeans arrived, which in the case of the Australian continent, Australia was the colonisers came, the British colonisers came in 1778, and of course things changed very rapidly. First of all, there was a huge impact on the Aboriginal population, as is very common. There were these kind of disease took a huge toll, and also there was a deliberate policy of removing people from their, forcibly removing people from their land. So we had, the USA was a little bit more organised, I understand. You actually declared war on your First Nations people and sent the army in. Ours was more, I'm not quite sure how to put it, less explicit, but no less violent, in terms of how Aboriginal people were removed from the land. And then, of course, over the last 200 years, we've had all the things happen to a continent that have happened to, the analogies with the USA are there to be made. We had large areas of the continent cleared for intensive agriculture. About half of the Australian continent is under a pastoral lease, which means that someone's got a legal license to grow sheep or cattle, and I mentioned that Australia was an island continent, and we had a large number of endemic species found nowhere else by definition. That's why they're endemic to Australia, including strange creatures such as the platypus and the echidna, all these marsupials, mammals that give birth to live young, but then crawl into a pouch you know, where they where they're nursed and raised to adulthood. So the Australian, for that reason, Australia's ecology is very susceptible to invasive plants and animals, because when you bring in plants and animals with invasive kind of traits from another continent that evolved in another biome, often they can run riot, and indeed this is what's happened here. So we've lost a lot of species from habitat loss and fragmentation, but most of our loss of biodiversity has actually been the direct or indirect result of a very large number of invasive species of both plants and animals. The fox and the cat have devastated native wildlife, to name a few of them. So Australia now has lost about 23 endemic native mammal species have gone extinct in the last 200 years, which is a terrible record. We have, you know, if you rank all the countries by the number of mammal species that have got extinct in the last 200 years, we win, unfortunately. It's a terrible record. So Australia has got, we still have a lot of land which has, where the basic vegetation cover is its natural vegetation ecosystems, but a lot of it's, you know, been degraded. A lot of it's plagued by invasive animals and weeds. So there's a lot of environmental problems we're dealing with here at the moment.
So before we go on, I have a terribly ignorant question, which is that in the United States, we have creatures like bison. There were 60 million, and they were reduced at one point to, 23 or something. And pronghorn antelope, there were 16 million. And there were so many salmon that rivers would be black and roiling, and so many passenger pigeons or Eskimo curlews that they would darken the sky for days at a time. And so when you talk about extinction, when you talk about the crash of biodiversity, are there also stories of that level of just what is to somebody today unbelievable fecundity?
Yeah, no, that's a very good observation on your part and a good question. So the Australian continent's quite different ecologically to North America, which, as you say, is incredibly fecund. And biologically productive. The Australian, 70%, 75% of the Australian continent is semi-arid or arid. And so not only is it dry, it's also, the rainfall is highly irregular. So, if we compare our arid zone to your arid zone, you have cacti in your arid zone, right? We have no cacti. One reason why you have cacti is your deserts get a small amount of rain. Obviously, that's why they're arid. But it's quite reliable. You know, there's a specific time of year when the rains will fall and cacti can recharge. The year-to-year variation in the arid and semi-arid zone in Australia is incredibly variable. Places may not get rain for 10 years. So the whole of the fauna, the wildlife, evolved so that they were adapted to these highly irregular, unpredictable conditions. And Australia's very, as I mentioned before, it's a very ancient landscape. It didn't get, the landscape, if you like, didn't get freshened up by the Ice Age, right? These are very deeply weathered, in geological terms, nutrient-poor landscapes in the main. So the biodiversity is more cryptic. The 23 mammal species I spoke about are quite small. They're not megafauna like your bisons. And our populations of many of our species naturally rise and fall with the change in the product, the natural variability in the productivity of the landscape. It's called boom and bust. It's kind of a boom and bust cycle. You have huge explosions of, when it rains in an arid zone or a semi-arid zone, you have huge explosions of wildlife, which then naturally die off as the productivity kind of eases away. So, yeah, the ecology is quite different. We didn't have, the equivalent of 60 million bison. It was a more kind of subtle, cryptic biodiversity on the Australian continent, which reflected how it had evolved in response to the natural conditions.
So you've talked a little bit about the effects of invasives and grazing. I don't remember if you mentioned clearing, but obviously industrial humans have affected the landscape of Australia very severely. And in your excellent essay on the future of conservation in the book Keeping the Wild, you talk about how there are those who argue, and neither you nor I would be two of these people who argue this. You say there are people who argue that that conservation or environmentalism or wildlife preservation, however we want to talk about this, there are those who argue that there should be new goals that, as you say, they are suggesting that the goal of conservation be abandoned and reinvented. The argument goes something like this. There's no longer any wildland. What we have left is in a semi-natural state, the product of human management and impacts. So we should think of ourselves more as gardeners who have to manage the planet carefully, ensuring that ecosystems remain healthy and providing people with food, water, and other ecosystem services. In brief, we need to domesticate nature more wisely. So first, before you talk about that, can you talk about, you say the goal of conservation should be abandoned and reinvented. Can you talk about what the goal of conservation was and what your goal of conservation is, and then talk about what these other people are suggesting the goal should be?
Yeah, sure. So just to be, so our listeners are clear, it's other people who are saying our conservation goals should change.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sorry if I wasn't clear on that. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm quite happy with our current conservation goals, but you know, as you read a number of and they're North American commentators who are arguing this, who are proposing that, you know, we're now in the era of the Anthropocene, you know, that the world is now dominated by humans. We're running the show. Nature as we know it's gone. Therefore, to try and continue to conserve nature is a hopeless goal, or even a foolhardy goal, because basically it doesn't exist anymore in a form that we should bother trying to protect. And that if we're going to save any of Earth's ecosystems from being completely cleared and industrialized, then we need to set ourselves the goal of being good land stewards in order to have healthy ecosystems that can provide benefits to humans. So what they're arguing is that the goal of conservation should be to manage landscapes so that they provide benefits to help people, human well-being. And you know, that has a certain appeal to people. And at one level, it's true. At one level, in one way, we are utterly dependent upon ecosystems. I mean, it is still unimaginable that humans, you know, humanity as we know it, can live anywhere else than on a planet with the planetary life support systems that we have. So it's absolutely true that humans derive benefits from healthy ecosystems.
It's embarrassing. It is embarrassing that you even have to say that.
Well, but that's the level of kind of ignorance we're dealing with. I mean, we are dealing, you know.
I mean, this is why so many Indigenous people say the land is everything, you know? Anyway, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. Yeah, I mean, it just shows you how disconnected we've become from really the kind of biological and ecological reality. So, you know, I am in no disagreement with these with people who argue that, you know, we have this close dependency on ecosystems and we derive benefits of all kinds from it. Of course we do. Where I disagree with them is when they say that we're in control, that we can manage these systems and direct them so that they give us the benefits that we want from them. That's where I think they're making a fatal mistake. I think that's, you know, that point of view is suffering from an excess of what I like to call human exceptionalism. You know, people will be familiar with the concept of the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene is actually a scientific term. It came from a chemist who argued that when you look around the planet today, you can see, you know, chemically in the atmosphere, in the ocean, in the soil, the kind of chemical signature of human impacts. You know, the human ecological footprint has now become so extensive that we're now impacting at a global scale. Well, a lot of people have interpreted that, the Anthropocene, to mean that we're in control. And I would argue that's not the case and can never be the case. The Anthropocene doesn't mean we're in control, it just means what it actually means is we're disruptive at global scale. You know, from a scientific point of view, Earth, or the Earth system, if you like, is what scientifically we call a complex adaptive system. There was a wonderful now deceased American systems thinker called Donella Meadows, whose work you might know of. She was at MIT, and she wrote very lucidly about the fact that you cannot manage or control complex adaptive systems. You can prod them, and they can unpredictably tip into different states, but they're not something that can be subject to command and control. So when we think that, you know, we fall into a terrible trap if we believe that we can control ecosystems so that they deliver things that we want from them. If we have a system where that's the case, it's not an ecosystem, it's an industrial system. That's the difference.
So let's back up a second. I really love what you're saying, and a couple things. One is, I've interviewed George Werthner a couple times, and a sort of joke that I have, that he and I have developed, I guess it's three times, and I guess this sort of joke that he and I have developed is, I will, whenever I get the chance, I will ask him, so can you name any, I don't generally use the word ecosystem because I prefer natural community following John Livingston, but we can go with either one. Can you name any natural community or ecosystem that has been extractively managed without being significantly harmed? And then he would just start laughing and say, of course I can't. So I'll ask you the same question. Can you name any natural community or ecosystem that has been managed for extractive purposes, which we can contrast with the people who lived in place there for 50,000 years, or I live on Talawa land where the Talawa lived here for at least 12,000. Can you name any natural community or ecosystem that has been extractively managed without significant harm to the natural community or ecosystem?
Well, no, I can't. And empirically, you won't find any data, you know, that can point to such a system. And when you think about it, you know, why would we expect otherwise? You know, when we use a ecosystem primarily to extract a raw material that is being input into an industrial process, and the rate at which we're extracting it and what we're extracting is demand driven, right? Then why would we expect anything else to happen? I mean, I'm surprised that anyone would think otherwise. So if you look at what's happened to the world fisheries, we've just fished our way down through the trophic levels, down through the food chain. We're doing the same thing with forests. We extract all the old growth timber. Then lo and behold, we don't have any old growth timber to make substantial long living wood based products from. So we just harvest baby trees that we can turn into pulp so we can make manufactured wood products. But now actually doing that from native forest turns out to be a lot more costly than doing it from plantations. So now certainly in Australia, they're now looking at burning forest biomass as a source of a supposed alternative energy, right? So they got rid of all the timber. They can't compete with plantations for pulp and manufactured wood products. So now they're down to just burning biomass. So, you know, when you just view an ecosystem as a source of a raw material into an industrial process serving a global market, it's inevitable that it will be downgraded and basically treated as a quarry.
So I love everything you're saying. And can you, because the cultural discourse is so lacking in so many ways, can you be really explicit about something you said a moment ago about how when you interfere, how did you say it? Something about interfering, attempting to manage a complex system, having unpredictable results. Can you be explicit about why that would be the case? And then also, can you give some examples of perhaps what people thought might be small changes that led to larger changes in the larger system / community?
Yeah, so we all know what a system is. It's a complex adaptive system is what is not a complex adaptive system? A car engine is not a complex adaptive system. A car engine is a simple system. Okay, you turn, assuming the car's been serviced, it's running, okay, you turn the key or press the ignition button and you know exactly what's going to happen. You put the foot on the accelerator or the brake, there's a predictable response. So the behavior of the system is predictable and subject to human management. You can tune the engine to perform in a certain way. A complex adaptive system isn't any of those.
Wait, you've got two different terms here. You've got simple and complex, and you've got nothing versus adaptive. So the car is simple and non-adaptive?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So it does change, but it only changes in one direction, and that's towards entropy. So all that a car engine can do is degrade.
Okay.
And it'll just wear out. So it requires constant human input to maintain it, and it's simple because it has its behavior is entirely predictable. A complex adaptive system has the opposite qualities. Its behavior is very difficult to predict, and it has what's called feedbacks. So feedbacks can be positive or negative. Something can affect the system to make it go faster, or something can affect the system to make it go slower. And often the responses are non-linear. You change one part of the system in a small way, and it has unexpected large consequences somewhere else, and it's dynamic. As external circumstances change, its internal interactions and functions and behavior changes as well. So it's in a dynamic relationship with the external environment, not a static one. So Earth in total can be validly understood as a complex adaptive system, and this is one of the problems we've got with the climate change problem at the moment. Is people think of the climate change problem being to do with the weather we experience in the atmosphere, but the weather we experience in the atmosphere is but one aspect of the whole Earth system's behavior that involves the exchange of energy and chemical compounds and water vapor between the atmosphere, the oceans, the land, and the geosphere. So Earth is definitely a complex adaptive system, Well, that means its behaviour is very hard, if not, is very hard to predict, and we can expect there to be positive and negative feedbacks, and we can expect non-linear responses. So we're seeing this with the whole issue of greenhouse gases. A lot of people say, well, why, you know, how on earth can burning fossil fuel affect the climate? Because we measure it in the atmosphere in parts per million. Huh? You know, we're talking about 400 parts per million. That's equivalent of about, what's that, a couple of cartons of milk emptied in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. How on earth can that affect that level of concentration, that minute concentration of this chemical substance change the climate? Well, it's because we're dealing with a complex adaptive system with non-linear responses. A very small change in the concentration of greenhouse gases, especially long-lived ones like carbon dioxide, has a dramatic effect on radiator forcing, and that relatively small increase in the amount of sunlight that's kept, or heat which is kept within the atmosphere, has these major ramifications. It's amplified through the system. So, you know, to me, the best example we can give of a complex adaptive system is Earth itself.
So can you talk about some sort of smaller scale, a change that people might have thought might have been fairly minor that ended up having bigger ramifications, like the removal of one small creature? Like, I know that I've read many times that the trees in salmon-based forests, I know that removing salmon is not trivial, but if you remove this, that the trees in salmon-based forests near the rivers will grow literally three times faster. So, what is some surprising connection that people may not have thought about and people wouldn't think about when you attempt to manage that? If you remove, I don't know, if you remove the platypus, you end up with some other, you know. Oh, another great example is when they reintroduced wolves to Yellowstone, it really helped the trout. So are there examples of that from Australia that you can think of?
Sure. And this is what's kind of called, you know, there's this whole ecological concept of, you know, trophic regulation, which is most often illustrated when we talk about when you remove large predators. So you've got a food chain at the top of these large predators, and if you remove them, that will have ramifications right down through the food chain. So if you remove a top predator, that can allow, well, let's say you've got a big predator feeding on a medium-sized predator, right? If you remove the big predator, you'll get an increase in the population of these meso predators. Well, that means there'll be that'll have an impact on the herbivores that they feed on. Right? There'll be fewer herbivores. Well, if there's fewer herbivores, then there'll be more of the plants they grow. So whenever you remove or dramatically reduce the size of one animal or one functional group, it has to have an effect which spreads through the ecosystem. So in Australia, we have the situation I mentioned about cats and foxes, which were introduced again by the British when they came here, and they really have a devastating effect on our small ground dwelling native marsupials and mammals, and our native rodents as well. They really get hammered by cats and foxes. Well, who was the top dog, so to speak? Who was the top predator on the land? Well, for the last 4,000 years, it's been a native dog called the dingo. Right? Now, I mentioned half the continent is under a form of tenure that gives people a lease to grow sheep or cattle. Well, sheep farmers hate dingoes because dingoes will take sheep. So most of the states have laws that enable dingoes to be killed. So what we've found now is where dingoes are like wolves. Actually, they're analogous to wolves. They're pack animals. They have an alpha and alpha male and female, and they're highly territorial, and they regulate their own population. There's only one breeding female in a pack, and she suppresses reproduction in the others. So when you have a healthy dingo pack in its territory, it actually has an incredible impact on cats and foxes. It basically eliminates foxes. If you have dingoes, you don't have foxes, and it greatly suppresses cats. So there's a huge net benefit to native wildlife. So even though dingoes eat native wildlife, because they regulate their population within the carrying capacity of the landscape, you actually get more native marsupials and mammals when you have healthy dingoes. If you randomly kill the dingoes, which is what farmers are licensed to do, then back come the cats and foxes, and they really trash they really hit the native wildlife. So this is a huge issue at the moment in Australia, because we kill a lot of dingoes, you know, every year. Thousands and thousands of dingoes are slaughtered every year, yet we've got this ongoing crisis with our native wildlife. So there's a real tension there. And it all comes from these trophic relationships.
So if we collectively were to have a prayer of actually managing a complex adaptive ecosystem, what that would mean is that we would have to have the capacity to predict every one of those relationships, and every one of those relationships that shift, that are themselves dynamic.
That's right. They're not constant. And as I said, as new circumstances arise and impact upon the system, it adapts. You know, it changes. So the only way you can control a system is by, I would argue, ecosystems by definition are complex adaptive systems, I would argue, and the only way you can control them is by making them simple systems, right? I.e. industrial systems, agro-industrial systems. So a plantation of trees, right? A plantation forest, which is planted as a crop of wood to feed a pulp mill, right? That's an agro-industrial system. It's not a complex adaptive system. It's more analogous. You know, it's probably more like a car engine than it is actually a natural ecosystem.
Well, and it is like a car engine in that it can only degrade, and it will eventually fall apart.
That's right. The trees that you put in an industrial plantation are bred to be short-lived, to grow fast and not. Most plantation trees these days are harvested within 20 years. Right? You don't need the tree to live for 400 years. Right? You only need it to live for 200 years. So the system is entirely dependent on constant human inputs. It's a crop. It's a crop of trees.
So you don't believe, and I am not challenging you here. I completely agree with you. You don't believe that that the sort of neo-environmentalist plan of managing the earth as a giant garden is, I think you and I would agree that that's not desirable, but in any case, you and I would probably also agree that that's also not possible.
Yes, I definitely think it's not possible, because the more you're able to control it, it means the more you've eliminated natural processes. And what makes an ecosystem resilient and adaptive and sustainable, you know, is its evolutionary adaptive capacity. It's the fact that it is a complex adaptive system that enables it to persist and change and evolve in the face of new circumstances. As soon as you simplify it and make a system dependent upon human inputs, it becomes highly brittle. I mean, you know, if we compare, you know, a native grassland ecosystem with a wheat field, The wheat field's quite productive. It's productive, though, for one thing only. That's we're optimising the system to produce wheat grain, and it requires huge inputs of fertilisers and energy, additional energy to the sunlight. But it's also highly brittle. It's not a very resilient system. It's a huge monoculture that's very exposed to the impact of diseases, right? Or even climate change. You know, it's not resilient in the face of new circumstances. But a complex adaptive system is. So there's a trade-off. Natural ecosystems might forego some short-term productivity in order to be more optimal, to be more optimally resilient in the longer term.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes left, and in a minute I'm going to ask you what perspective, how you would like to perceive the world rather than perceiving it as a garden. You know, what would be, how do you think we should look at it, which I think you've been making clear all along. But before we get there, I want to ask you something, and I'm not meaning to challenge you, and I agree with everything you're saying, but I'm wondering about, you just said that a wheat field is brittle, and I completely agree that it's brittle in terms of the wheat field being wheat field. Can we also consider that brittleness an attempt on the land's part to become a prairie again? Huh. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. I mean, the only way it's not going to become a prairie again is by humans continually to put these management inputs, you know, into it to continue. So long as we keep feeding that landscape, the fertilizers and the herbicides and the weedicides, the pesticides, we're stopping any adaptation from happening. You know, we're stopping natural dispersal from bringing seed in. We're stopping natural selection from operating so that the most suitable phenotype is reproducing, you know, etc. So all those natural processes we're stopping by this continuous input of basically energy and chemicals.
And so
much of which is to stop those natural processes from happening. So yeah, if we just back off, you know, natural processes will take over and it will turn into something else. Now, what it does, what it would turn into, time would tell.
Because really a garden, a garden is basically attempts to impede succession.
Well, it's to impose a human order.
Right, and one of the ways one does that is by impeding the succession.
That's right, yeah.
It would cause it to become prairie, forest, whatever it's going to be.
That's
so basically, what we're saying when we're saying we want to make, whoever is saying when they're saying they want to make the world a garden, is they're saying that they want to attempt to impede succession, which means also they're attempting to fight nature.
Well, they're putting themselves up against Earth's natural life processes, and in which case they've kind of aligned themselves with a very kind of hyper, uber industrial view of humans' relationships with Earth. I mean, it's terribly kind of overly techno-optimistic. You know, it's overly optimistic about humans' capacity to control natural processes. And we don't have a lot of evidence, for that at this point in time, I would suggest. So I think, the idea of working, certainly Earth is our home, we live here, we have to grow food, we have an ecological footprint, it's too large at the moment, we have to reduce it so it's sustainable, but so long as humans are here, we're going to have a footprint on Earth, and we have to accept that. But surely, it's got to be about how can we live, more sustainably with nature, rather than had this, you know, position of real hubris that we've got the capacity to dominate and control nature. Because again, it's also in denial of our own nature, of our own biology, of our own ecology.
So what would you, we have probably 4 or 5 minutes left, and what would you, can you be more explicit about the contrast to the sort of gardening or controlling perspective, and what do you want to substitute for an anthropocentric paradigm? So somebody's listening to this interview, how do you want them to change how they perceive the world around them?
Well, it would be, philosophically speaking, more ecocentric. I think a lot of traditional cultures had what I would call an ecocentric view, though they may not call an ecocentric view. I'm very interested in the Australian Aboriginal concept of what they call in the English, translated into English language, it's called traditional obligations to country. They don't see themselves as owning country, they see themselves as having obligations to. So country is the word they use for their land. Their ancestral land, they call country, and they talk about their traditional obligations to country. So to me, the Anthropocene does not mean that we turn Earth into a garden for human use. It means that we learn to I would call it a more biosensitive understanding of our place on Earth, and finding ways to work with nature rather than against nature. And I would say trying to turn Earth into a garden is working against nature. It's not working with nature. You know, we still do not really have any scientific understanding or theory that explains how life evolved from non-life. As far as we know, the only evidence of life we have on the universe is what we have here on this planet. The best kind of scientific understanding suggests, you know, if life does exist elsewhere, it's still a rare event. It only occurs under particular circumstances. So I think we need to think about our obligations to Earth. I think if the Anthropocene means anything to me, it means that we must assume greater responsibility for the state of the planet, the welfare of others, the greater community of life, and what we leave for future generations. So the Anthropocene is not about controlling nature. It's about understanding what our responsibilities are towards nature.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful note to end on. So I would like to, first off, I would like to thank you for everything you've said. It's fabulous. It's really important. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Brendan Mackey. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.